Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us today. Going to be talking about finances, things such as living, not running out of money when you retire, and how to plan for that. And my guest is Tom O'Rourke. He's a well-known attorney in Rockville, based in Rockville with Miles and Sturbridge. Did I get that
Stockbridge.
Right? Stockbridge. Miles and Stockbridge. And an expert on estate planning and that sort of thing. But we got a number of emails from people who have questions for Tom. So let's start off with that, and then we'll go into the regular show. This is from Kevin, and he says, "Good morning, Mike and Tom. I'm in my early 20s, recently graduated college last year with a low amount of debt, thank the Lord. I've been in the government for about a year now and have taken full advantage of the match for the TSP." So he's obviously putting in 5%. "I'm slowly looking towards increasing the amount of my contributions in the Roth TSP once my income level rises. I've also built an emergency fund, and I almost have enough to cover 4 to 6 months of my expenses. With all that said, what should be my next priority once I get rid of all the debt and have an emergency fund ready? Do I max out the TSP, start a health savings plan, invest directly in individual stocks? Where do I put myself as a millennial in a stronger financial position? I wish this guy was Secretary of the Treasury."
You ought to have Kevin in there as a guest.
Wow, absolutely, yeah.
Kevin seems to be doing everything right. Putting money into the Roth TSP makes a whole lot of sense for young people because over the course of he's starting out at probably the lowest income tax bracket he's ever going to be in for the rest of his life.
Right.
So taking advantage of a tax deduction for putting money into the TSP really doesn't benefit Kevin that much or other people in Kevin's age group. Putting money into the Roth TSP makes a whole lot of sense for people who are young, who have a long time to watch their money grow, and who are now in a relatively low tax bracket. If Kevin's federal career proceeds like most federal careers do, he's gradually going to increase in grade, his salary's going to go up, and all that money in the Roth TSP is going to accumulate tax-free. Now, in answer to his question, what should he be doing next? He should keep on doing what he's doing, but the one thing I tell people all the time is that any lawyer, any financial advisor, any CPA that you talk to will always tell you a very wise course of action is to put as much money into the TSP as you can afford and as the law allows. And if Kevin could afford to do it, I'm assuming he's well under 50, he could put as much as $18,000 a year into the thrift. Now, he probably can't do that because he's got other obligations. He's got rent or car payment or stuff like that. But he should put in as much as possible after he achieves the goals he's outlined here.
And he did say he's getting the government match, so that means he's putting in at least 5%.
The absolute no-brainer for anybody covered by FERS is put in at least 5%. If you aren't doing that, you're walking away from free money by not taking advantage of the full government match.
Got three questions here all about trusts. One is from Normand and says, "Besides cost, what are the disadvantages of a trust?" Here's one from Michelle. "I have a question regarding a revocable trust. Both my husband and I each have a revocable trust, but neither one of us has taken steps to place our assets into it. So I'm wondering if it is not better to simply cancel the trust, and how do we go about doing that, or do we even need to do it? Thanks in advance." And then there's another one here. Would you first explain, because there's several kinds of trusts, correct?
Right. The two very, very broad categories of trust is a revocable or revocable trust. And it's just as the name suggests, the person that creates it retains the right to revoke it or change it anytime they want. The second broad category of trust is an irrevocable trust, one which once it's put in place, cannot be revoked or changed. It's considerably more complex. It's a separate taxable entity, and it's not widely used by many people, except for tax planning purposes. The trust that most people use as part of their estate plan is a revocable or revocable trust. It's a tool that I use all the time. It allows the person who creates it to retain total control of their assets. It doesn't complicate your tax filing situation at all. You use your Social Security number as a trust tax ID number. You don't file any special tax forms. You don't give up any tax benefits. You don't get any special advantages. And you retain a right to revoke it or change it anytime you want. Now, in order to get all those advantages, your trust has actually got to own your assets. You must title assets in the name of the trust. And as Michelle indicated in her question, if she and her husband have trust but have not funded them, have not titled their assets in the name of the trust is just a document on a piece of paper. It's meaningless. It doesn't do anything. If she wants to get rid of the trust, she needs to do is tear it up.
Yeah.
Because it really
there's,
is not
there,
a it's
there's
a,
no
right
there,
now,
there huh?
It's a plan waiting to be implemented. Now, since she's gone to the time and expense of having the trust created, I would encourage her to take a look at it. And if it still does what she wants it to do, I would encourage she and her husband to title her assets in the name of the trust. Now, that's not a big deal. For real estate, usually the lawyer who creates the trust prepares a deed, entitles your home in the name of the trust. Now, you're not giving up any right to do mm-hmm. anything with that home. You can still sell it. You can still refinance it. So you aren't giving up any flexibility. With respect to your financial assets, all you need to do is talk to your bank or your financial advisor or your mutual fund company and take the assets out of the name of Tom O'Rourke and put them in the name of the Tom O'Rourke Revocable Trust. I still retain control of it, give up no flexibility, and it's a very simple thing to do. And two main reasons why I encourage people to consider revocable trust is, number one, if you ever lose the ability to manage your affairs, it allows somebody, it allows your successor trustee, a person mm-hmm. you would name, to step in and manage your assets for your benefit. The other reason I recommend it is it allows your heirs to avoid probate after you die. It's a whole lot easier to unwind your affairs if you have a trust after your death. But you only get those advantages if the trust actually owns your property. So I would encourage Michelle to take a look at her trust. If it does what she wants it to do, she should go ahead and fund it.
Okay. And funding it, you go to the bank or you get a document and say, I want this in my
sure.
trust?
Sure. For example, many people, to the extent they have investments, have them in mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to the website of any, you know, Fidelity or Vanguard or whoever, and you simply fill out a change of registration form. And in your case, you would take that account out of the name of Mike Causey
mm-hmm.
and put it into the name of Mike Causey Revocable Trust, Mike Causey Trustee.
I see. Okay.
It's still your account. You still pay tax on the income. All you're doing is changing the title.
It sounds good, too.
Yeah, it really does. It accomplishes a lot of goals.
Yeah. Okay. Another question here. Let's see. This is from John. What are one's planning options for management of one's assets and other non-fiduciary matters if there are no competent, trusted family or friends available to assist an individual as they incrementally progress to a lower cognitive state? Would one set up a revocable trust before designating a law firm, wealth management company, or such other entity with a fiduciary responsibility with a durable power of attorney? That's a lot of power and responsibility to hand over to an unknown party. How can one be sure they won't be abused or robbed blind? Is there any accounting oversight mandated by states? How would a designated fiduciary know when to initiate the management of someone's affairs who's losing cognitive ability? What trigger mechanisms should be in place to initiate outside assistance? And that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, it's a lot of questions, and there are a lot of very difficult questions, and unfortunately, there's no ideal answer. The most typical situation that I deal with is people are aware of that. They're aware that as they age, they may lose the ability to manage their affairs. And the ideal is to have a trusted, loving family member step in and take over. But if you don't have that trusted, loving family member, there are a lot of folks in the D.C. area that don't have children and reach a point in their lives where they can't manage their affairs. The only practical alternative in those situations is to get a professional to do it. Lawyers do stuff like that, although I don't like to do that
mm-hmm.
because, you know, many of the decisions are intensely personal.
Sure.
The entities that most typically do it are bank trust departments. Now, the really good thing about a bank trust department is, number one, they know what they're doing. And number two, they won't steal your money. They Bank of America or SunTrust has more money and more liability than anybody listening to this radio show. They aren't going to do something stupid and take advantage of you. They will manage your affairs. They'll manage them wisely. Now, the bad thing is they may not know you personally. They may not know your needs and your desires. And it costs money. You, when you hire a professional, you've got to pay the fees for that professional. And many times that's a drawback. And in the D.C. area, if you hire a professional trustee, a bank or trust company or a financial institution, they're going to charge you a fee that could be in the range of $5,000 a year. Now, professional trustees that I deal with tell me our clients always think they're getting their money's worth. And in most cases, they truly are. They do a good job of managing money. But it does cost money. But they'll manage your funds wisely.
Okay. Need to take a short break here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke. He is an attorney based in Rockville that handles does estate planning and has many, many federal clients. And Tom, I was recalling when the first time I think we met, it was at a FDR, Federal Dispute Resolution Conference, 20 plus, maybe more years ago. And I was covering it, and I wanted, there were a lot of speakers and seminars and things, and I wanted to pop into each one and or at least the interesting sounding ones, and stay for 10 or 20 minutes, get an idea of it, and then move on. And I went into yours. It was a 2-hour program, as I recall, and I was just mesmerized by it. It was so good. So I appreciate having known you all these years and dealing with you, but this was just wonderful stuff, and I don't particularly like things like this.
Yeah. Well, Mike, what you neglected to mention, you're very kind, and I appreciate that. But the FDR conference was in Palm Springs, California, in August, and the temperature outside was about 115 degrees. So even listening to a lawyer talk about estate planning was preferable to being outside.
Well, I love the way they handle the air conditioning. You'd eat outside, and it was so dry that they just spray little jets of water, and it was perfect.
It was relatively comfortable.
Yeah, if anybody wants to offer me a place in Palm Springs, I'll take it. Yeah. But get back to this John R's question. He had so many here, but the bottom line was you think you're losing it. You've got dementia. You've got a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. What do you do?
Well, and his question was, what is the trigger mechanism for somebody stepping in? I mean, problem number one is finding somebody or some organization that you can trust and rely on. And absent any close friends or family members, I think the best option is an institution, a bank or an advisory firm. But another extremely difficult question is, how do you know when to step aside and let them step in? And many times, if your capacity is becoming diminished, you may be the last person to recognize that. In most cases where it's time for a family member to step in, you're aware of that because the family members recognize it. Not only is mom losing her keys, she forgets where she is. She forgets the name of her children. She doesn't realize that she doesn't need a winter coat in the middle of July when she goes out, and it becomes readily apparent. But if you live alone, it's probably best to err on the side of caution. Allow that professional, that institution, to step in and start taking over before it becomes absolutely necessary. The other advantage of that is you'll have an opportunity to observe what kind of a job they're doing, and if necessary, find somebody else if they're not doing it to your satisfaction.
Yeah, that's a good
point. So those are really tough issues, and all any lawyer, all any estate planner can do is give you the tools to deal with very difficult issues. The mere fact that you have the legal authority to deal with those issues isn't going to make it any easier. The toughest decision many family members have to make is, when do I take the car keys away from mom or dad? That's a very, very difficult situation. I still remember the story of a good friend of mine who was taking care of her 90-year-old father, and she woke up one morning. Dad parked his car in front of her house, and she woke up, and the car wasn't there. But Dad was at the breakfast table. To make a long story short, somebody had stolen the car. The woman's reaction was, thank God my prayers are answered, not I want to get the car back.
Yeah.
So that can be a very, very difficult situation to deal with.
And I know you and I talked about it before, too, but you have a situation, and I've seen 3-4 cases of this firsthand where there were a number of siblings, 3 or 4, and the parent is either incapacitated or dies, but particularly when they die, it splits the family up, fighting over the meanest little thing, a tea kettle, ersatz antique. Yeah. And that's when it's good to have an outsider who has the authority to say, this is the way it's going to be.
Well, every time somebody mentions that to me, I think of a client I had a number of years ago, an elderly lady who passed away. And before she passed away, she asked me if I would be the executor of her estate, her personal representative. I said, yes, yeah. But I said, you've got 4 very capable, very successful children. Mm-hmm. She said, oh, I know. They're all very smart, and they could all do the job. But, Tom, I've learned from my own experience that many times they have to make unpopular decisions. Yeah. And that creates family discord. And she said, to be quite honest with you, I want my children to get along with each other. I don't care if they don't like you.
Yeah.
Which was a very pragmatic position to take.
Yeah, yeah, tough job. Okay, one more question here from Rochelle. My question, when picking beneficiaries on your TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, is it more sensible to split or leave all to a spouse if you are 72 and spouse is 74. If you leave it all to the spouse and your money does not run out, are you making a contribution to the government or will it go into your estate? Also, what happens with the pension in the same situation?
Well, if you have a spouse, that answers a lot of questions.
Yeah.
If you have a spouse, it goes to your spouse. If it's your annuity, if you elect a survivor annuity, it continues for your life and your spouse's life. And it lasts as long as either you or your spouse do. You'll never run out of money. You'll get a cost of living increase every year if the cost of living justifies that. But when your spouse dies, that's it. You don't waste your money. The TSP is another story. It's a set amount of money sitting in an account. The big advantage of naming a spouse is a spouse takes the money, they can roll over the money tax-free into their own IRA and avoid paying taxes. But Rochelle's question says, what if my husband is over age 70? He's got to start taking money. Everybody's got to start taking money out of a tax-deferred plan when they reach age 70 and a half. So the real question is, does your spouse need the money to live on? And if he does, you naturally want to provide the annuity for them. If you think your spouse may need money, you can roll it over. He can take yearly withdrawals, and it gets set into his own account. Then when he dies, if there's anything left in that account, it goes to whomever he designates as a beneficiary. For money in the thrift plan, it always passes to your designated beneficiary. If you haven't designated any beneficiaries, you have no spouse, you have no children, and you don't do anything, it'll pass into your estate and be distributed in the manner you specify in your will, if you have a will. And if you don't have a will, it'll pass to your next of kin, whoever that may be under state law. But the money in the TSP is yours. It doesn't revert back to the government.
You know, I'm always surprised, and not in Rochelle's case, but I've talked to a number of people, and they're really upset about this required minimum distribution. You said you have to take it at age 70 and a half, and it's a percentage. It's actuarial percentage,
right.
But it's a relatively small amount of money, isn't it?
Right. In the first years, it's about 3.75% of the amount you have in there, and it gradually increases as you get older. As you get older, your life expectancy declines, and the theory is you will exhaust your money when you die.
Yeah.
Now, under the IRS life expectancy tables, they assume you'll live to 115.
Okay.
So obviously, people aren't going to live that long.
Yeah.
So for most people, they're usually required to take out when they first reach age 70, around 4%. It gradually increases till you're about 80. You got to take out about 5%, And as you go beyond 80, it increases and can go up to as high as 10%.
Right. And again, too, so many people look at it as somehow as a loss. But really, there's no law that says you have to spend that money.
Absolutely not.
You can take it and put it in another.
The whole theory is that in order to encourage you to retire, the federal government gives you a big tax incentive. Mm-hmm. You put money into a tax-deferred plan like the TSP, you save taxes. But you got to pay that back at some time. It's to encourage you to save for retirement. It's not supposed to be a forever tax shelter for rich people.
Yeah.
And then when you reach retirement age, you got to start paying back that tax benefit. You got to take money out and you got to pay taxes on it.
And as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, too, in the case of this young guy that wrote us and said he needed help, he sure didn't need much help, but he, very smart fellow. But a Roth IRA for somebody like that is just ideal.
Well, for a person like Kevin who starts out in his early 20s, putting at least 5% into his TSP, he's going to be a millionaire several times over. And for somebody like Kevin who's put it in a Roth, when he takes the money out, he's not going to have to pay any taxes on it. And if the money's in a Roth IRA is the only tax-deferred vehicle I'm aware of that required minimum distribution rule doesn't apply. If you have a Roth IRA, you don't have to take money out. Now, that's a Roth IRA. It's not a Roth TSP. Mm-hmm. If you have money in a Roth TSP, the required minimum distribution rules apply to you like they do to everybody else.
I'd take it if I had $1 million. I would accept those ground rules.
Well, when I, as you know, I teach a lot of classes on retirement planning, and in one section, I always give an example. My son delivered a newspaper when he was 6 years old. It was a weekly newspaper, mm-hmm. and I set up an IRA account for him. And after a while, he had about $2,000 in there. And the example I use, I like it because it's such an outrageous example. If I took the money and invested it in the S&P 500, the Standard & Poor's 500, and left it sit there for 53 years, mm-hmm. until my son reached 59 and a half, that $2,000 would have grown to a little over $1 million.
Oh, yeah.
That's the benefit of tax-deferred compounding. So, again, Kevin is the guy that ought to be teaching these classes and hosting shows like this one.
The miracle of compounding. Got to take a short break here, and we'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and I'm talking with Tom O'Rourke. He's a well-known estate attorney and planner, if I got the titles correct, Tom.
All of them fit.
All of the above, and I know you teach, you do a lot of seminars. In fact, we met at a seminar in Palm Springs, talk about name-dropping, and just so glad to have you with us today. And why don't you just talk for a minute about when somebody comes in or when you have a seminar or a class, what do you tell them?
Okay. I always start out in an estate planning seminar by telling people that any estate plan needs to accomplish four very basic goals. First, it should allow you to retain control of your assets. Whatever you have is yours, you should be able to use those assets in any way you want. Secondly, every estate plan needs to include a mechanism that deals with the issue of disability. What happens if you reach a point in your life where you no longer have the ability to manage your assets? You should address that in your estate plan. And then third, and this is what most people think of when they think about estate planning, is who am I going to distribute my assets to following my death? And most people automatically think, I need an estate plan, I need a will. Well, you probably do, but there are a lot of ways other than a will to make sure your assets go where you want them to go. For federal employees, usually the most important estate planning tool is their ability to designate a beneficiary. Their TSP, their life insurance, their annuity, they designate beneficiaries for all those. You can also use either a will or a trust. And many times when people own assets jointly, typically a married couple tend to own most assets jointly. And when one spouse or the other dies, those assets automatically go to the joint owner. But any estate plan should allow you to distribute any assets in any way you want. And then the fourth basic goal is you want to accomplish all of these other goals at the lowest overall cost. And the cost associated with estate planning is, what are you going to hire? What are you going to pay the lawyer you hire to do the estate plan? Secondly, what probate costs are you going to incur or possibly avoid? And then third, what taxes are you going to have to pay to state or federal government officials? And the one issue that's kind of becoming a non-issue for many folks, particularly most folks that I deal with, is taxes. The federal estate tax exemption this year in 2016 is $5,450,000 per person. So I always tell people, to the extent you've managed to hold your assets below $5.4 million, you've done a great job with tax planning.
I've done a good job.
So yeah. And most people have.
Yeah.
So that's usually how I start out. And then we spend a fair amount of time talking how you accomplish those goals. And I find myself more and more emphasizing dealing with the issue of disability. People are living longer, but many times they reach a point in their life where they no longer have the ability to manage their affairs. And there are two ways to deal with disability. If you become incapacitated and you've done nothing, hopefully somebody cares enough about you to take care of you. But the only way they can get the legal authority to do that is to go to court and seek to be appointed your guardian. You can avoid that by having a power of attorney, a document in which you name a person of your choosing or an institution to step in and manage your affairs if you don't have the ability to do that. And right now, it's relatively fresh in my mind as to why it's important to have a power of attorney. A little less than a year ago, I dealt with an elderly lady. She was in her late 80s, and she wanted me to revise her will, which I did. And I suggested to her, you should also have a financial power of attorney. She said, no, I don't want to give anybody the authority to manage my affairs. So she refused to do it. And to make a long story short, she became incapacitated. Her family became aware of that when they got a call from a Maryland state trooper. She had run out of gas on the Beltway. She was going from Bethesda to D.C., by way of Annapolis, obviously, for people who are outside this area. That's the wrong direction.
Yeah.
She's totally confused. And a lot of things needed to be done on her behalf. Bills had to be paid. Tax returns had to be filed. Checks needed to be deposited. Nobody had the authority to do that. She had one adult daughter whom she loved and trusted dearly. We had to go to court and have daughter appointed a guardian. That proceeding, simple, uncontested, took about 5 months, and total fees, costs for court costs, legal fees, and doctor fees were about $15,000, all of which could have been avoided by simply having a power of attorney. And the point I emphasize all the time is people never know when they may get disabled. Got a call Saturday morning in my office. Fortunately, I was there, from a client whose husband had been rushed to the hospital with a stroke. She had no authority to act on her behalf. And I said, look, we did a power of attorney for you. I'll fax it to you. Mm-hmm. And I did. And fortunately, that allowed her to act on her husband's behalf. She still had to deal with the horrible issues of him having a stroke, but at least she had the legal authority to do it. So
just being his wife wasn't good enough?
Being his wife wasn't good enough.
Wow.
No. And that's a misconception many people have.
Oh.
You love your spouse, you trust your spouse completely, you own everything jointly. But another example I use, if you own a house jointly with your spouse and you need to refinance the house, maybe to do some remodeling, just because you're married to somebody doesn't give them the authority to borrow money in your name. You've got to have a document that authorizes them to do that, and that document is the power of attorney.
Yeah. Well, you know, I could see that as a layman, but with the medical part of it, you'd think, if the wife brings the guy in.
Well, many times state law, if you haven't done anything, and the example I always use is a horrible example of Terry Schiavo, the young woman in Florida who was in a comatose state for 14 years.
Yeah.
And she was the subject of a court battle between her husband and her parents. But under most laws, under most state laws, if you are in a vegetative state and you're terminally ill, state law will give your spouse the right, or your next of kin the right, to make decisions on your behalf, even if you don't have a power of attorney. But that's only the authority to pull the plug.
Right.
It doesn't give them the authority to admit you to or discharge you from a nursing home or to consent to medical treatment. It doesn't waive the privacy requirements of the HIPAA laws, which prevent your healthcare providers from disclosing your personal information to third parties. So powers of attorney are very simple to implement, and they're something everybody needs to have. And although the one bit of advice I always give people, don't rely on forms to do what a lawyer should do. The one exception I have to that are powers of attorney. You can get powers of attorney that are expressly approved by the attorney general in your state by spending a little bit of time on the internet, and you can print out these forms, get them signed, get them witnessed, get them notarized, and you really can do it at virtually no cost, and it's something that's extremely important and everybody needs to do.
Okay, and those off the internet are legitimate. They're state approved.
Yeah, generally, the only thing you need to have for them to be legitimate is, number one, they got to be in writing. Mm. Number two, they've got to be witnessed. Somebody's got to be able to say, yeah, Mike really did know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. He was fully in control of his faculties. And that's it. Now, sometimes some of the internet forums leave a lot to be desired, but my feeling is something is always better than nothing. Even if the only thing that form does is designate somebody to act on your behalf, it's better than not having anything.
Yeah, okay. And a notary would serve, too, if you can find one.
Absolutely. And if you can't find a notary, just get them witnessed. Because at least in the local area, in the D.C. area, the fact that a form is not notarized does not make it legally deficient.
You know, you're talking about disability, and sometimes the individual is the last one to recognize it.
Absolutely.
Which makes perfect sense. And someone once told me, they said, losing your keys, misplacing your keys is not the problem. The problem is when you don't know what the keys are for.
Right. And unfortunately, that does happen.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
No. Well, the other tool, and this is a little more sophisticated for folks who are worried about the issue of disability, is a revocable trust. If you create a revocable trust and put your assets in that trust, you will always name a successor trustee, a person who can step in and take over in the event of your disability. If you have a revocable trust, it very easily allows somebody you love and trust, somebody of your choosing, to step in and manage your affairs for you. So that's a tool. Revocable trust really serves two purposes. Number one, it protects you in the event of disability. You have a mechanism there to allow somebody you trust to deal with your issues. And number two, following your death, it allows your heirs to avoid probate.
We just got a couple of minutes before the next break, but word about long-term care insurance. What's your thinking on that?
Well, long-term care insurance, an issue that as people do tend to live longer, many times they reach a point where they don't have the ability to manage their affairs. And oftentimes that means a stay in a nursing home or the need to pay for a home health care provider. It's a risk. The possibility that you'll become disabled is a risk. And generally the way people deal with risks is they insure against it. When you drive your car, some idiot may rear-end you. So what do? You buy car insurance. You're afraid your house will catch fire or be destroyed in a hurricane, you buy house insurance. If you're concerned about the need for long-term care, you buy long-term care insurance. And it is something, I know the government has a program which at least has overseen, and it's something people certainly need to consider. And it's something that, in looking at your future, if you have family members who have spent the last 10, 15 years of their life in a nursing home, you may be a very good candidate for long-term care insurance.
My mother was a government worker, and she had long-term care insurance, and she suffered from dementia the last year, and it was a godsend for her and for her family. I mean, it was a gift to the family, if you will.
Earlier this week, I met with a gentleman whose wife recently passed away. He had her in a nursing home. Their monthly costs were $13,000 a month. So that's why long-term care insurance can be essential.
Take a short break. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and talking with Tom O'Rourke, a well-known estate planner, attorney in the Washington area. We wanted to dedicate this last half to a friend of ours, and whether you know it or not, probably a friend of yours, G. Jerry Shaw. Jerry was in the member of the federal family for years. He died last week, sadly, long extended illness, and I don't know where to begin, Tom.
Well, Jerry was one of a kind. He's a guy that I met. He was my first boss when I worked for the federal government at IRS, and Jerry was a very, very dynamic guy, and I know he was just a mentor for many people, myself included. He gave me enough flexibility in my job to do what I think I needed to do, but would always step in when I would screw things up, which
happened.
In my case, was quite regular.
Yeah.
But he always did it with a very diplomatic hand, and Jerry was... he was really a wonderful guy, and he was a true friend of federal employees. Much of his career was devoted to representing senior-level executives, but he did a lot for people other than senior executives. And Jerry's one legacy is he was one of the driving forces in setting up the Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund. Jerry, along with Bob Tobias and the former head of the National Federation of Federal Employees, Jim Pierce, and Steve Bauer, who was the head of the National Social Security Managers Association, got together. They all worked with and dealt with federal employees and knew that federal employees were really sort of the backbone of our country, and that many federal employees encountered difficulties from time to time and needed a hand. So Jerry and Bob and Jim and Steve got together. They realized they fought like crazy with each other in their day jobs in representing management and labor, but they all had one common goal and interest, and that was to promote the interest of federal employees. And they founded the Federal Employees Education and Assistance Fund. I think it's been about 30 years now. The organization had some difficult times when it got started, but it's firmly established now. It's helped federal employees who've been adversely affected by the Oklahoma City bombing, by Hurricane Andrew in South Florida, by the World Trade Center bombing. FEA has been there to help federal employees, and it's a tribute to not only to Jerry, but to the other gentlemen who were involved in setting up that organization.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable. All of Jerry's life, going way, way back, he was in Vietnam. He was a dust-off pilot, which is a very dangerous job, and he was in the medic end of it. So they would go out after another helicopter had crashed or there'd been a firefight and they were wounded, and they would land in this hot zone and pick up people and take them away. And Jerry was shot down twice. And as you told me beforehand, I hadn't realized he won the distinguished, or he was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, which is one of the highest honors you can get. And they don't hand those out lightly.
No, for anybody who's been in the military, they realize that the Distinguished Flying Cross is just a notch or two below the Medal of Honor.
Yeah.
And as you said, they don't hand them out. It's people who put their life on the line to sacrifice for their fellow soldiers, and Jerry did that. He did it willingly, and although I didn't serve with Jerry in the military, I had an opportunity to work with him and deal with him for 30 years after both of us got out of the military, and he was somebody who looked out for the interest of his fellow soldiers, of his fellow employees, and his partners in his law firm, of which I was one for many years.
Well, I find it interesting that, and not surprising, that even in war, Jerry was out there saving lives, trying to save American lives.
Yes, and
typical.
After he left military service, he continued to do that, first as a rookie lawyer with IRS, and then advancing the interest of federal employees. Jerry worked in conjunction with many federal employee organizations, and another one of his legacy organizations is an organization called the Public Employees Roundtable, which is a coalition of various federal employee groups. Jerry was the driving force behind putting that coalition together to work on behalf of federal employees. Something else that's one of his legacies, Mike, we could spend hours talking about Jerry's legacy, was every year in May, They have the Public Service Recognition Week. That was Jerry's brainchild.
Yep.
Jerry and other folks in the Public Employees Roundtable realized that federal employees in many instances get a bad rap. The only time people hears about them is when somebody in Congress is criticizing them for long wait lines at an airport.
Yeah.
or whatever. Jerry and the people on the Public Employees Roundtable realize that federal employees do many, many very important things, and their achievements oftentimes are overlooked. They started the Public Service Recognition Week so federal employees would be given the recognition that they deserve.
Yeah, and he was also, they took his law firm, Shaw Brunsford Roth, took over the Federal Dispute Resolution Conference, the FDR conference that I mentioned. That's where I actually met you.
Yeah, right.
Jerry was the driving force behind that.
Jerry was the manager behind that. He realized that many times there are a lot of disputes arise in the federal workforce, and what we need to do is put together all the people involved in resolving those disputes, EEOC, MSPB, Labor Department, anybody who had anything at all to do with disputes in the federal workforce would come together. They would meet each other informally. They would have continuing education courses and hopefully get to know each other informally to make it a little bit easier to deal with some of the difficult problems that cause disputes in the federal sector.
Well, that's one of the things that Jerry and others realized. Bill Bransford later took it over for Jerry, but that it helps to know people on a human level. And going to the FDR conference, it's not just a matter of networking so that you can maybe get a better job, but it's networking so that you know people in other agencies or people in your agency that are doing different things, and you can pick up the phone and call them. I guess people still use the telephone.
I think on occasion.
Yeah, the older types. But you can actually get with somebody that you've met in these conferences in a more relaxed atmosphere. So it's a wonderful thing. And as you said about FEA, the Federal Employees Education Assistance Fund, Steve Bauer, the executive director, has gone to Florida with a suitcase full of money to distribute it to federal workers who were hit by hurricanes, and the ATMs are knocked out. Nothing's working, and their FEA is there with cash. And they've also had some very generous corporate grants and ongoing grants from places like GEICO and Blue Cross Blue Shield and Long-Term Care Partners. So yeah. Amazing operation.
And one of the things that I would be remiss if I didn't mention is FEA occupied a special place in Jerry's heart, and his family has asked anybody who wants to remember Jerry to do it by making a contribution to FEA. If you go to their website, feea.org, they'll give you instructions on how to do it, and that will help you say thank you in a small way to Jerry, and also thank you to your fellow federal employees who may need a hand at some point in the future, and FEA will be there for you.
They don't make Jerry Shaws. Thank you. Last word. We'll see you all next Wednesday. Have a good week.